Well, it's time, and I can't see a thing with this light shining on me, so we'll have to make the best of it. My name's Alan Eastman. I'm the chair for today's session, which is number 124, Compassionate Obsolescence, Coping with Technological Change. Our speaker today is Carl Youngblood, a founding member of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. You may wonder, if you don't already know what Mormon transhumanists are, it sounds a little bit sinister. What it really is kind of an extension of the idea that men can become other than what they are now. In essence, we can be better if we go about it right. In more practical terms, the Mormon Transhumanist Organization tries to rationalize and make sense of the science and religion conundrums to help understand spiritual things more efficiently by means of scientific and technological means. If that's incorrect, Carl, please correct me.
Sounds
Carl
good.
Himself has a degree in computers in Portuguese, I guess, from BYU, and a master's in computer science from the University of Washington. He's basically a software engineer, now working for Cisco in Oslo. If you're not computer geeky, Cisco does networking, but it also does a lot of other things. Worldwide company. I'm not sure how much he has a chance to use Portuguese in Oslo. He's going to talk to us today about how we cope with technological change. Just to give you a little bit of background, my smartphone has approximately 800 to several thousand times, depending on how you measure it, the computing power of the system that took first astronauts to the moon. Famous quotes, Chester Carlson in 1948, the founder of IBM, opined that the world market for computers would be about four. That's four computers. I have more than that in the car I drove here in this morning. Steve Jobs of Apple opined fairly early on that he couldn't imagine why anyone would need more than 512 kilobytes of memory in a computer. This one has 16 gigabytes, or approximately, 20,000 times more than that. We are all coping with an amazing degree of technological change, sometimes faster than we seem to be able to accumulate it. My mother, who is 87, has no idea what to do with a computer. There are lots of people with whom I graduated from high school. I'm kind of leading edge baby boomer. Our generation has been the one that first got the blast of computer technology. Because I'm a chemist, I've learned how to cope, but I have an awful lot of friends who are just totally baffled. And I think what's going to happen today is Carl is going to tell us all how to cope with it. All yours, Carl.
Thanks, Alan.
Please speak loud. We need to record this for the Sunstone tapes.
That was actually Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft,
Bill Gates. Okay.
Who said no one needs more than 640K. But you were, the essence of everything you said was absolutely correct. Thank you very much for the introduction. So, all around us, people are becoming increasingly alarmed at the pace of technological change. A wide range of jobs are being automated and outsourced. And at the same time, pressure increases on the developing world to produce more and more electronics as rumors of abusive labor practices at electronics factories sound like they came straight out of a Dickens novel. Even, or perhaps especially, those at the forefront of technological change find it hard to keep up. Despite its challenges, this era also presents us with unprecedented opportunities, as various barriers to entry are lowered in education and other economic sectors. How do we navigate these challenges and opportunities successfully? Perhaps we can begin by looking back. If you were to choose the most definitive characteristic of humanness, what would it be? Rather than a specific set of activities, appearances, clothing, or tools, we might say that humans, more than anything else, have sought for mastery, excellence, to push beyond their present boundaries and do things better than before. They were humans in transition. They were transhumans. This drive has been manifest ever since our ancestors first began using tools and continues unabated today. It is at the heart of transhumanism. Last time I gave this talk, it was at the Mormon Transhumanist Association conference in April, so most of the people there already knew what transhumanism was. But I thought I should give a brief introduction and just explain it a little. Transhumanism is a broad movement of various people from various backgrounds, most of whom are secular, but some of whom are also religious. But it's a general observation about the progress of humanity and how it's accelerating in our present time. So there's lots of different things about it. It might be something to look up on Wikipedia or something after this talk. This process of improving on our existing tools takes many forms and is often marked by market and social upheavals. One increasingly common pattern that Mormon business analyst Clayton Christensen identified is something he called disruptive change. Disruptive change happens when cheaper and ironically inferior products are made available to a new class of consumers. The temptation is for the market leaders to ignore these products, since they seem to pose no real threat to their business. But products that were once inferior tend to rapidly catch up with the quality of the market leaders, usually at a price point that they can't compete with. By the time it gets to this point, it is usually too late for the erstwhile market leader to do much about it. In the 1970s, Japanese imports were cheap, and it showed. They were smaller, less powerful, more dangerous, and rusted easier, but they were inexpensive and therefore easier to own. To the dominant U.S. automakers, they weren't a threat. They were clearly inferior. But they eventually grew up, leaving U.S. automakers scrambling to compete. The computing industry has followed a similar trajectory. Ken Olson and his company, Digital Equipment Corporation, had enormous success selling smaller, less capable computers to companies who previously couldn't afford them. While market leaders like IBM were selling this, the mainframe computer, he sold this, the mini computer. So it's ironic that Ken is probably most famous for saying, "There is no reason for any individual to have a computer in his home." The only thing they could sort of think of was maybe you could do with this was like store recipes on your computer. And they just thought that most homemakers wouldn't be that interested. Sure enough, when it first appeared on the scene, the personal computer was an absurd novelty to any serious business owner. Given the extreme constraints on its memory and processing power, there was very little it could actually do. But the PC and the platform it later became standardized on quickly dominated the market, and the vast majority of the computers running on the internet today are based on it. We are currently witnessing disruption in mobile computing. While servers will likely continue for some time on their current platform, the number of mobile devices in use has already surpassed the number of PCs, and mobile adoption continues to accelerate, as opposed to the PC market, which has already matured. A common side effect of this disruption is unemployment. Workers who manufactured, serviced, and built products based on the aging platforms must quickly adapt to new market conditions or be displaced. Inevitably, not everyone makes this transition successfully. The past few centuries have been witness to one change after another, both revolutionary and disruptive, and they have been accompanied by frequent social upheaval. The textile industry drove the Industrial Revolution. When John Kay patented the flying shuttle in 1733, he made it possible for weavers to be more productive and make longer materials than before. But the home-based textile industry could no longer compete. A mob broke into Kay's house and broke one of his looms, though he fortunately had a few spares. James Hargreaves also suffered the wrath of local spinners with his invention of the spinning jenny, which overhauled the process of making wool into thread. By the time Richard Arkwright really got things going with his spinning frame, which used water wheels and later steam engines to mass produce yarn, a network of over 5,000 men was used to respond to any mobs threatening to destroy Arkwright's factory, which had become critical to Derbyshire's economy. In 1779, Ned Ludd and a group of workers, the so-called Luddites, destroyed several stocking frames that they considered a threat to their jobs as artisans. Similar violent reactions occurred in other disrupted industries. Another common reaction to technological change is alarmism and sensationalism, especially in relation to vital social institutions. Author Genevieve Bell points out that moral panic is remarkably stable, and it is always played out in the bodies of women and children. There was initial resistance to electrified homes due to the possibility that it would make women and children vulnerable to predators who could see if they were home at night. Others threatened that women were simply not designed for railroad travel, and that speeds in excess of 50 miles per hour could cause their uteruses to detach. Technology has also been the instrument of political change. Gutenberg's printing press was an essential enabler of the Protestant Reformation, in which the priesthood of all believers encouraged every man to read and interpret his own personal copy of the Bible. The underground publishing movement in Soviet Russia was kicked into overdrive by the advent of the fax machine. Some have argued that the so-called Arab Spring was catalyzed by widespread internet access. Bahrainis have become more acutely aware of the gross inequity between the Sunni ruling classes and the Shiite commoners by looking at satellite maps on Google Earth and seeing that the Sunnis possessed almost all of the land in the area. Tunisians, Egyptians, Libyans, Syrians, and others have vented their frustrations and organized resistance efforts much more efficiently by using online social networks. In addition to making many tasks easier, technological advances have given us more leisure time. Clay Shirky calls this the cognitive surplus, and he notes that each generation has had trouble dealing with all this extra time. According to Shirky, the unprecedented levels of alcoholism and its attendant evils during the gin craze of the 18th century was not an original problem, but a reaction to it. Specifically, dramatic social change and the inability of the contemporary civic models to adapt to it. The conditions of the marginal classes during these transitional periods have often been brutal, but the consensus among economists seems to be that trying to avoid them only tends to prolong the agony. Even the likes of Paul Krugman, a well-known left-leaning economist, sing the praises of sweatshop labor. Quote, "It is the indirect and unintended result of the actions of soulless multinationals and rapacious local entrepreneurs, whose only concern was to take advantage of the profit opportunities offered by cheap labor. It is not an edifying spectacle, but no matter how base the motives of those involved, the result has been to move hundreds of millions of people from abject poverty to something still awful, but nonetheless significantly better. The fastest way to improve a country's standard of living seems to be to let industrialization run its course. That doesn't mean that there's nothing we can do about the plight of poor workers, which I'll hopefully talk about in a minute. Today, we're faced with similar challenges to previous generations, but they are exacerbated by the accelerating pace of technological change. There's not enough time to give a laundry list, so I'd like to highlight what I believe is perhaps the factor that contributes most in the current phase of accelerating change. That is the rise of general purpose computing and the concept called Moore's Law. The concept of a machine that could be programmed to perform any task and not just a specific task, like the other automata of the Industrial Revolution, originated with Charles Babbage in collaboration with Ada Lovelace, a brilliant female mathematician. Ada Lovelace, incidentally, is kind of a hero of many feminists, as one of the first female scientists to really contribute to the field of computer science. One of the founders of the field. Babbage's machine, the Difference Engine, was extremely complex and never fully built in his lifetime, but it was the beginning of general-purpose computing. It's since been reproduced. So this was not fully built in his lifetime, but people who are enthusiasts of this built this computer. Since then, these theories have developed into the now flourishing field of computer science. Computers are ubiquitous and improving all the time. In 1965, Intel co-founder Gordon Moore observed that the amount of circuitry that engineers could fit into a given space was doubling about every 2 years. This process has come to be called Moore's Law and has continued unabated since his seminal paper. It has come to govern the whole computing industry. Many have predicted its demise and been disappointed. Every time scientists started hitting the theoretical limits of a given technology, new processes and technologies were invented that allowed Moore's Law to continue. So if you look at the top of this chart, you can see they show a punch card and a transistor of some kind, a switch or relay switch, a vacuum tube, and then they have some integrated circuits. And this represents kind of the different phases in technology. So as they got to the vacuum tube, for example, everyone said, well, we can't get vacuum tubes any smaller, so Moore's Law is going to, well, at the time, Moore hadn't yet identified his law, but basically, we're not going to be able to progress much past this. But a new technology was invented that allowed engineers to continue to miniaturize the process. And as far as we can tell, that's still going strong. Chip manufacturers and integrators base all their financial projections and targets on this law. The continued growth of the industry depends on it. And most scientists believe that although there is an upper limit on how optimally matter can be arranged for computation, we are nowhere near it. Moore's Law will continue for at least a few more decades. And this exponential progress in computation is having and will continue to have a profound impact on all aspects of society. By the end of the decade, the average computer will have roughly the computational capacity of the human brain. This doesn't mean it will be able to think like humans, but that it performs roughly the same number of computations per second that scientists believe are going on in our brains, based on various experiments. That's impressive, but where the power of exponential growth really kicks in is if you wait a few more decades, a couple more decades. At the current rate of progress, by 2045, the average computer will have roughly the same computational capacity as all the brains in the entire world combined. And they will be everywhere, in your pocket, in your appliances, vehicles, even in your body. This is the average computer, not some fancy supercomputer in a lab somewhere. So problems in biology and other sciences that currently take us vast clusters of computers many days or months or even years to solve will be solved by this average computer in a matter of seconds. It can hardly be overstated how much this will change our world. Though we can barely predict the impact of these changes, such examples at least help us to acquire the necessary prerequisites of awe and concern over what we face. Let's briefly discuss some of the challenges that these changes are causing and will continue to cause. Popular essayist and entrepreneur Paul Graham points out that the same trends that contribute to technological progress also tend to optimize the addictiveness of things we like. And that as technology progresses, we should expect addictive behaviors to become so common that only people who vigilantly resist will not have succumbed to some type of addiction. It's happening all around us. We can't stop checking our Facebook or our email. We have to watch the latest episode of American Idol or check the score of the game. Clay Shirky claims that TV has replaced gin as the focus of our cognitive surplus. Mm-hmm. And he points out that all the information on Wikipedia, an invaluable resource curated entirely by amateur volunteers, required only 5% of the time that Americans spend watching TV in 1 year. So that huge resource that we all go to when we want to check something was done in a very small fraction of all the free time that we Americans have. Even industries with extensive physical infrastructures are being obviated by software. Two quick examples. Airbnb is disrupting the hotel industry, and Uber is disrupting the taxi industry. You may have never heard of these companies, but they're growing very rapidly right now. I have at the end of my slides, I have a link where all of the various talks and books and things that I've mentioned during this talk will be located, so feel free to check that out. Other industries in attempts to maximize shareholder value, which, by the way, Steve Denning recently called the dumbest idea in the world, have outsourced more and more of their processes until before they knew it, all they had left was a brand. This has essentially happened to Dell. These missteps and disruptions mean lost jobs, or more precisely, shifts in demand. Jobs in some sectors are disappearing while demand in other sectors is growing. Of course, these shifts are not neatly confined to national borders. Peter Thiel argues that this trend towards global allocation of labor and resources is irreversible. The current global population and infrastructure cannot be sustained with the efficiency levels of previous eras. If we had to give up petroleum-based agriculture, for example, half of the population of the Earth would die. So we have to figure out how to solve these problems because we simply can't go back. We can't go back to an idyllic world of the way we previously did things. So some of the solutions that people are presenting are failing to take into account kind of the predicament we've gotten ourselves into in the first place. Are these changes, and these changes are only the beginning of sorrows. There is a growing sense of future shock as we realize that we are no longer capable of managing the amount of information that is available to us. So how do we handle all this? There's not time to provide a comprehensive list, and I admit that my list will focus more heavily on knowledge workers. But I'm going to try also to share some general coping strategies. One technique that has always served us well are better tools. The knowledge worker of today has to process more information than ever before, so the tools he uses need to be adapted to this new reality. For those of you who are dealing with information overload and addictiveness, an excellent new reference is Clay A. Johnson's Information Diet. This is the cover of the book, which is full of techniques and suggested programs for helping you to become more productive and healthier about how you consume information. Another excellent reference is Getting Things Done by David Allen. For example, you can use tools like SaneBox to help you filter and prioritize your email. It sends most of your email into kind of a separate folder automatically because it's really good at sensing whether a message is really important and needs to be responded to now or whether it's something you can wait and check on later. RSS readers are a great way of processing your most important sources of information more quickly. These are things that you can use to aggregate all of the news that you check on a regular basis into one place and then just read it in a single session rather than browsing around. Twitter lists. This is a feature of Twitter where you can find a list of all the most influential people in a given subject or topic and just subscribe to their tweets so that you can see kind of they can filter all this information for you and just present you with the most salient things that you're interested in. Rescue Time is another tool that can help you track how long you spend in different applications and analyze your behavior patterns to help you improve your work habits. So it will tell you if you're spending too much time checking your Facebook or something like that. Accelerating change means that no job is safe for long. Today's workers should expect to experience significant changes in profession during their lifetimes, especially if their lifetimes are continuing to increase in life expectancy. Education will be increasingly important, and fortunately, great things are happening here. MITx offers a wide variety of its courses online in a format where you can watch video lectures, follow along with the homework, take exams, and even get assistance from a TA, all for free. No tuition. Stanford, the University of Washington, and 14 other universities, more all the time. Just since I last gave this talk, like 14 more universities signed up. It was only three, I think, before. So they've joined an initiative called Coursera, offering similar courses. These are top-notch courses from some of the best universities in the world, all free. A wide variety of free learning options are also available on Apple's iTunes U. Entirely new online universities are also innovating in this space. Sebastian Thrun, former Stanford professor and Google employee who helped make amazing advances in the field of autonomous vehicles, started an online university called Udacity after teaching a remarkably successful online course at Stanford. Demand for the course was unexpected and overwhelming. Hundreds of the top students in the course were in developing countries and yet outperformed the local Stanford participants. It was amazing. 410 of the top students were all online from other countries of the world, probably not with even English as their first language. And the 411th student was a Stanford student, which is, you know, a very prestigious university. So it goes to show how hungry people out there are for learning and how the educational space is really being disrupted right now. Thrun was so excited that he decided to pursue online education full-time, and he founded this this university. Other sites like Khan Academy will teach you everything from basic math to calculus, as well as history, chemistry, biology, and other subjects. One area where the demand for jobs... I should mention also that Khan Academy lets you practice problems as well and kind of quiz yourself, and so brush up on your math if you've gotten a little bit forgotten some things, like I think all of us have. One area where the demand for jobs is especially high right now is in software engineering. And there are entire sites dedicated to teaching it to you for free in a step-by-step way, starting from scratch. Codecademy is one of them. There's also Treehouse and Code School. There's such a high demand for engineers right now that a company called Living Social has founded something they call the Hungry Academy. And they will pay you while you learn how to code with their experts. And then they'll give you an opportunity for full-time employment with them. So they're that desperate for engineers right now. Of course, there is an application process and a screening process, but for people who are enthusiastic and eager to learn, they're really willing to bring them on board. So it's really amazing what's going on right now. There are plenty of resources for other industries also. Stack Exchange is a site where professionals ask and answer questions, learning from each other. They have categories for chefs, photographers, writers, mechanics, woodworkers, musicians, you name it. Many other online communities have lowered the barrier to entry and made it possible for a variety of professionals to improve their skills and effectiveness. I should mention they also welcome amateurs in these communities. If you still haven't mastered the basics, take a free hands-on workshop at the Apple Store or a summer course at your local community college. New services are also becoming available that make it easier than ever to start a business or to do work in more efficient ways. Services like Square and Stripe allow you to accept credit cards without the hassle of setting up a merchant account. They simply transfer the money directly into your bank account, with much simpler fee structures and very competitive rates. Telepresence technologies like Skype allow you to work with customers anywhere in the world. And cloud-based hosting services like Heroku allow you to deploy a scale-on-demand website or application in seconds without having to worry about managing a costly IT infrastructure. These tools and strategies are just some of the things coming online today, and they will no doubt continue to get better. Open source, community-driven collaboration strategies are being used to innovate more rapidly than was possible with single companies using closed development strategies. We can expect that future tools will be even easier to use. As I share these suggestions and ideas, I realize that many people will not be in a position to take advantage of them. While some of the trends I reviewed are already helping the disenfranchised to gain greater access, there is also a lot that we can do. I believe helping others to adapt is also in our self-interest if we wish to avoid more painful and dangerous societal schisms. We can begin by helping our loved ones. Tools like Skype, remote desktop, and Crossloop can make it easier for you to help your less tech-savvy relatives with computer problems or training. Rather than wait for industry or the public sector to fix things, grassroots movements are cropping up all over the place where passionate amateurs are bypassing the status quo. So I'm going to talk about a few of those right now. In only a few years, the DIY bio community, that's DIY for do-it-yourself, a group of amateur biologists mostly working from home, has already created an open-source database of over 5,000 different biobricks. These are simple biological systems from standardized interchangeable parts, essentially like Legos except with DNA instead of Legos. And, you know, anyone who wants to use them can license them. I guess what you do is you promise that anything that you develop based on these technologies, you will contribute back to the community. So it's kind of a great snowball effect that is really changing the industry, moving away from a proprietary model into something that's more collaborative and hopefully eventually is more efficient than the private initiatives. Open source ecology is a network of farmers, engineers, and supporters building something they call the Global Village Construction Set. It's a modular, do-it-yourself, low-cost, high-performance platform that allows for the easy fabrication of the 50 different industrial machines that it takes to build a small, sustainable civilization with modern comforts. That was from their website. I thought, since this is such, I think this is exemplary of the kinds of initiatives that are cropping up and how they're changing the way people collaborate with one another, I thought it would be interesting to share a 5-minute video of this this particular movement with you guys. So I'm going to pull that up now. Let's see if I can just...
A scarcity-based economy is the status quo of today. Because of the way human relations have evolved, and not everybody is provided for, there's a lot of suffering going on. In the absolute abundance of resources, namely rocks, sunlight, plants, water, from which all the wealth of the economy comes, their distribution to humans is very much corrupted, and there's material deprivation going on all these fronts, such that people are hungry or in poverty. Resource conflicts exist, and so forth. So post-scarcity would be where we're connected more closely to the natural resources from where all wealth comes by the fact that we have the means, the tools to transform those resources into the feedstocks of modern civilization. Open-source ecology refers to the integration of human and natural ecosystems along the lines of open-source principles. When we say open-source, that means open collaboration, open sharing of development and ultimately of economically significant information. We're developing the Global Village Construction Set as a means to show that, one, we can create a real community based on these technologies and achieve post-scarcity. The Global Village Construction Set is a set of 50 different industrial machines that allow for the easy fabrication of all the different products that it takes to create a small civilization with modern comforts. Everything from a tractor to an oven to a circuit maker. Tractors being such a fundamental device, access to them should be easy to make survival simple. So we've decided to build out of necessity, because our tractors, industrial tractors that we bought, kept on breaking. We built our own to first do construction, in fact, and to do basic agriculture in the experiment of trying to recreate civilization from scratch. So we decided to build the most simple possible device, and to do that, you need a frame, and we decided to use an XYZ construction type of a frame with bolt together members and put on a power unit. Initially, we didn't do a removable power unit. We did hydraulics because they're versatile. And soon it turned out, well, if we're going to have a power unit, why don't we design it such that it can be interchangeable using our hypermodularity concept? The power cube is a modular power source. It's an example of a power source that can be interchanged between various applications, as opposed to be firmly attached to one device, serving as a power source for one device. Its range of use is unlimited. The key to making it so versatile is that you're transmitting power from this power cube by means of hydraulics, which is hydraulic oil flowing in tubes, which therefore allows you to carry large amounts of power in a very flexible way by quick connect couplers that plug in from the power cube into the device that you're powering. Currently, we're using petrochemical hydraulic fluid because that's the only thing that's available on the market. Now, there also is available canola oil with additives as a biohydraulic fluid, and that's something we can grow on the farm here with our combine and oil expression and have locally made hydraulic fluid. Combined with the local production of hydraulic motors and modern steam engines, you can have a total resilient infrastructure for producing power. Compressed earthquake presses. We call it the liberator, as in liberating you from the main cost in your life, which is housing. If you have one of these machines, you can make bricks, which principle can suffice to build an entire house, including roofing and flooring. Compressed earth brick, to my knowledge, is the only technique that's rapid construction, requires minimal equipment, and can get you both natural and industrial scale building. It's driven by hydraulic power from a power cube, so you can stand a power cube alone. The basic design of the machine is a compression frame, so you start with that frame, which basically is this part from here to there, and the rest is everything that supports that compression. So you've got the secondary cylinder that moves a drawer in and out to load soil. You've got a huge hopper that can be loaded with a tractor. We are the only operation, or only CEB pressing operation, that does this, which means a device that pulverizes and loads the soil in one step. You use double CEB walls with straw bales in between. That's a hybrid CEB straw bale construction. That, to me, could perhaps be the next generation of housing for humanity. HabLab, 10 living unit arrangement. Double CEB walls, 3,000 square feet, and a straw bale roof and walls. This relates to the technology of the Global Village construction set in that there's a tractor, soil pulverizer, CEB press, power cubes that are being used right now as we speak. There's another technology, the gasifier burner, that's going into this structure that's all part of the technologies. Now, you see in modern civilization, we have run away. The technology base has totally run away. Instead of our lives being more based on leisure time, where we can actually do things that are most meaningful and we can improve ourselves as people and learn to get along, we're struggling on basic resource scarcities. Our technology is so complicated, it takes us so much time, so much energy to maintain it, that you're back to the dog race. We're trying to see if that's changeable by reducing the technology to the most simple yet sufficient modular, Lego-like, people tech imaginable.
Okay, so I hope that gave you a little bit of an idea of what they're doing with this project. What I thought was most remarkable about this whole thing was that they really are looking at the practical, nitty-gritty, kind of hands-on, how do we make these things work, rather than just sort of retreating into ideology. And this is just one example among many, and this is something you can contribute to if you'd like. There are people who are actually going there. It's some place. It's actually in Jackson County or right by it. So I like to say that it's almost like they're building Zion right now. And
so if we Googled open source ecology, we could see that. Right?
Yep, and I, as I said, all of the links of everything that I've mentioned in my talk, I'll be sharing at the end. I'll give you a web link where you can get that all. But there are also people who are sponsoring them monetarily, who are just contributing a few dollars a month or whatever, just because, you know, they can't be out there on the farm, but they can sort of help contribute. And their goal is to create pilot projects all over the world that are kind of mimicking what they're currently experimenting with, because they're documenting the entire process of all of the ins and outs and sort of the troubleshooting that they go through as they try to work out these things, and then sharing them with the rest of the world. So the so-called maker movement consists of local groups of hardware enthusiasts and tinkerers, everything from electrical engineers to machinists, who get together to build useful gadgets and talk shop. Many of their inventions are competitive with commercial options, but cost something like $300 instead of $300,000. This is another example of a movement that's really taking off right now. There's maker fairs all over the world. This is pictures from a maker fair in San Francisco, one of the biggest ones. But everyone from all age groups, all walks of life, are building things, all sorts of crazy things, and just sharing how they do it with each other. P2P lending sites like Kiva are making it possible for you and me to help entrepreneurs in the developing world lift themselves out of poverty. By 2009, the site had over 180,000 entrepreneurs receiving $1 million in loans per week, and the repayment rate is over 98%. So one specific initiative that I've been involved with is the Mormon Transhumanist Association. We seek to promote radical human flourishing through the charitable use of science and technology, and we're also interested in helping to reconcile science and religion and help people see that they can benefit from and inform one another. So these are just a few of the examples of some initiatives that you can get involved in if you feel like you're already coping to a certain degree or have certain means at your disposal and would like to help those who are struggling to cope. For more insights on how upcoming technological trends will enable us to better meet the population's needs and manage our planet's resources, I highly recommend this book, Abundance, by Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler. It contains numerous suggestions for projects and initiatives like the ones I've mentioned that you can contribute to also. It also really describes how many of the things that we think are such unsolvable problems will really be radically transformed by some of the accelerating trends in technology. So one thing I want to make clear in summary is my firm belief, despite challenges, that things are getting better. This is not a zero-sum game. When we improve how we do things, the things humans value increase in abundance. Steven Pinker has done an excellent job of demonstrating that violence has dropped dramatically from prior eras and continues to do so. Even though we see it on TV all the time, it's because journalists and reporters are scraping the bottom of the barrel to find violence wherever it occurs, rather than because it's actually increasing. It's gone way, way down, and it's decreasing rapidly. Better communication and utilization of our resources ultimately results in more equality, more happiness, and more abundance as we grow closer to the ideal community we strive for. And the Lord called his people Zion, because they were of one heart and one mind and dwelt in righteousness, and there was no poor among them. Thank you.
We have time for some questions. I'm sure Carl is ready, willing, and eager to answer them.
Are those the links?
Yeah, so all the links can be found there. There at the bottom of the page on that link, you'll see something that says My Sunstone 2012 Talk. Just click on it and you'll see everything.
For those who are listening to the tape, it's http://youngbloods.org.
Thank you. I hadn't thought of that.
Have you, the last couple of years and accelerating recently, major universities?
Actually, we I mentioned a bunch of educational initiatives that are happening right now.
Have they thought how to monetize that? So,
Carl, could you repeat the question so that the tape will get it?
So the question was regarding changes changes in the educational sector. A bunch of universities have started different initiatives to provide free online education. I think basically there's a general consensus right now among experts in education that tuition rates are climbing much more rapidly than the rate of inflation, and that we are experiencing a bubble in the educational sector. And they all see the correction coming. They see the writing on the wall. They're very concerned about it. But they're dealing with a lot of entrenched interests, and it's kind of difficult to know how exactly to transform the university. But at the same time, they're kind of experimenting with some of these initiatives. I don't think they're yet at the stage where they've figured out how to monetize that. But I think that access to experts in the field will always be curated and regulated to a certain degree, because that will be a scarcity. I think that will continue to be a scarcity, something that people can charge for. But I think that just a credential may become much, much less, much easier to get, and the access to education will be so widespread and so easy to have access to that the monetary value of a credential will decrease probably. I think that they will start to, I'm not sure, but I think universities may see themselves as more and more research institutions and less sources for education.
Yes, it's just a guess. If I could stick in a little bit of something there, I've taken one or two of the online courses offered by MIT, and what I find is that many of those courses are taught by young bucks who want to make a name for themselves. The high reputation professors usually don't teach those, but the younger guys who still have lots of fire in their belly are going to teach them. They turn out to be really excellent teachers. One I took was linear algebra, which is a ghastly math class, but it was actually understandable done that way. So, you know, highly recommended. Go ahead, Carl.
Thanks. That's so no, they haven't really figured out how to monetize this yet, but and I don't know what's going to happen there. I'm sorry, I don't have more insight. But
I was very intrigued by this open source video you showed about, you know, the whole idea of how do you lift people out of poverty by recreating the beginnings of civilization where people can live together and have their basic needs met. And I'm sitting here thinking, if I were
Could you come up and just say that where the tape recorder can pick you up? That would be a much better way to do this. People who are listening to it are going to watch
this open source video talking about how to create a society, how to lift people who are living in dire poverty and recreate the beginnings of a civilized society where people can work together and live together in a community and build houses and be self-sufficient. What I was thinking is, if I were a young capitalist from Bain Capital, that would scare me to death. I'm wondering how much pressure the capitalistic system would put on this whole idea of open source and lifting people out of poverty, like in Eastern China or something.
Yeah,
teaching people to be self-sufficient and build their own little communities and take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. I think we can at least see we can point to some previous examples of how the entrenched kind of players reacted to these things, with the way Microsoft reacted to the open source software movement, which is already quite mature at this point. At first, they talked about how inferior open source software was, and it really was in many ways. It still hasn't made it to the desktop. You know, I shouldn't say that. Many of the things running my Mac right now are based on open source software. So even companies like Apple and Microsoft are now heavily using open source technologies because they realize that we've reached a critical mass where the quality of open source software is so much better than anything that one company could make, because there's millions of eyeballs all looking at it and improving it and adding to it. So they usually start out resisting it when it's small, but when it gets bigger, they tend to kind of try to adapt and somehow leverage it in some way. But whenever someone leverages open source technology, the groups that do this are using the copyright system, using the legal system to enforce compliance. So they really are dependent on our existing legal infrastructure, because all most open source licenses say that if you use any of this technology, you have to contribute anything you do back to the community. So if someone, say, builds a web server or something and they sell it and it's using open source technology, they have to provide any modifications that they made to the public to download and use as well. So it's really a great model because it enforces collaboration and sharing. And so I think, I don't know for sure, but I think that many capitalist, many companies that are out there that are providing some services that might compete with this open source ecology movement would start to get on board eventually and would kind of collaborate in the movement as well.
Now, also by analogy to the open source software, if you look at Microsoft and Apple's reaction to it, what they have done is they have catered to people who are a little bit queasy about using open source and want the kind of higher level bells and whistles that private industry can provide at a nice profit. I suspect in open source housing, if you are a little bit nervous about having a house built out of mud bricks and straw, enterprising guy out there is going to find you something made out of fired bricks and tubifores for a nice profit. Oh, it's if the software industry is any platform to judge by, entrepreneurs will find a way to monetize extensions of the open source technology.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that sounds kind of hopeful.
Yeah, I think that it doesn't necessarily have to be a cataclysmic failure of the old system. It can be sort of a gradual, or not so gradual, adaptation. Do we have any time left?
Yeah, we have about 5 more minutes. Time for a couple questions, or if not.
No one's asked me anything about Mormon transhumanism.
All right. What about Mormon transhumanism?
So, we founded the organization. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. We founded in 2006, and we published our first big paper in Sunstone Magazine around that time, maybe 2007, just a little thereafter. And it's still online at transfigurism.org. That's a pretty good introduction to some of the things that we found. But I guess if I could summarize what kind of prompted us to get going with this, some colleagues and friends of mine, we had all sort of remarked of how we found many inspiring principles in Mormonism. But we felt like many of the most inspiring things that we're taught are the most vague, the things that we have the least inkling of how we might progress towards these eventualities. So we talked about, the discussion of the renewal of the earth and the millennium and the transformation that's supposed to occur and all those things. And we thought most of us are just passively believing in these things without doing anything to try to promote them. And we wondered if perhaps some of these prophetic visions were dependent on our action, right? There, it may be that these things will not occur unless we actually do something about it. In fact, I think there's a strong precedent in Mormon thought for the fact that God will never sort of impose paradise upon us. It's something that we kind of have to build for ourselves. Brigham Young said that you are in as great a kingdom as you will ever attain to unless you make it yourselves. And so we felt that maybe it was high time that we started exercising some practical faith in some things, some of these prophetic visions and things that could eventually come about. We have another member here, Joey West. Another question. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm just a member of the...
Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry. Doe, yeah, Doe. I've never met you in person, so it's great to finally meet you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway,
I was actually going to ask a question. Though.
Okay.
If you could maybe talk a little bit about the conflict that Mormon transhumanism has experienced from other transhumanists.
Yeah.
Hey, the question was, could Thanks. Carl explain a little bit of some of the or describe some of the conflicts that Mormon transhumanists have experienced from other transhumanists?
Thanks. So one quick thing I should say introducing this response is that one of the things we wanted to do as an organization was show Mormonism how it could benefit from a more sort of rational approach to its theology, but also show transhumanists how they could benefit from a religious perspective. Because most transhumanists are very secular. In fact, some of them are kind of new atheists, sort of rabidly anti-religious. And there was a lot of debate in the World Transhumanist World Transhumanist Association, which has now rebranded itself to something they call Humanity Plus, about whether they would allow us to be an affiliate of the World Transhumanist Association. And it went back and forth, and there was a lot of debate among the board members on that. But they eventually did allow us to affiliate, and so we are a sort of affiliate organization of Humanity Plus, we've built a lot of inroads to, I think, the transhumanist community, and many of the more thoughtful, I would say, more sort of those who have a more mature aesthetic among them, seem to be very welcoming of our organization. And our organization happens to be one of the most active transhumanist associations out there. So they're all like going, how are you guys getting all these things done? Even though we feel like we're not getting hardly anything done, you know? So it does seem to be like that maybe some of that Mormon organizational expertise is coming into play here. But I think that we are building some bridges, but I think there still are a few that are highly suspicious of us.
We're about to the end.
It helps to have a vision.
Yeah. It helps to have a vision, yeah. And the vision that I have at this point is that our time is about up. I'd like to lead us in giving Carl another round of applause for a really fine session.
Thank you
very much.
Just want to say, please feel free to go to transfigurism.org and see if you agree with some of the principles we are advocating, and if you are, you're welcome to join the association. It's free membership. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.